Welcome to the Scientist Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to understand the realities of research life. We bring you into the lives of top academics so that you can get to know the people behind the research that's shaping our world. I'm Jamie, your host, and in this podcast, I'll be bringing you candid conversations each week with those on the cutting edge of their fields. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Scientist Podcast. Today I'm speaking to physicist Dr. Jessica Wade. She's an Imperial College Research Fellow working in the SPIN Lab and has done an enormous amount for inclusion in science. Jessica, how are you?
I'm really great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, it's so cool to have you here. Before we properly jump in, I have to ask, is it true that Casio released a calculator with your picture on it? What was that like?
It's completely mortifying and embarrassing is what it's like. So Casio, you know, long celebrity in my mind for making calculators that we've probably all used and rely on daily. I actually often thought about Imperial as being probably the one place in London where you could look around and know most people had a calculator in their bag. I think they came across the story of what I was doing on trying to increase the recognition and celebration of women and people of color scientists. And they thought the story was really sweet. So they emailed and said, we want to make a calculator. We're making some calculators with like cool women scientists on, and can we put you on? And I was like, ha, 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 of course, like thinking it was a joke because Casio is, you know, they're not going to put me on a calculator. Anyway, it turns out it wasn't a joke. I was up alongside people like Marie Curie and Rosalind Franklin and all of these phenomenal, you know, huge legacy women scientists. And there's just me being like, you know, Wikipedia is really cool. So there is a calculator. No one should buy it. It's completely mortifying and embarrassing, but it's great that Casio is still doing the work to advocate for underrepresented groups.
No, that is totally not the sell. As a physicist, that is the highest honor. There's no honor Imperial or the state could bestow upon you.
When I get to becoming a professor, I'll make it mandatory for everyone in the class. Like, you don't only have to have this Casio calculator, it has to be the one with me on the front of it, okay? And then you'll get full marks.
Yeah, it's the one where you get a really like specific spec for your calculator. Racket, Wade edition. Everyone's going, what's that edition? Yeah, so both your parents were doctors and your brother's a doctor. What's conversation like at dinner growing up? Sciencey, I'm guessing.
Yeah, super sciencey. It's very intense. You know, the past year has made it even more intense. I think we grew up kind of interested in science and asking questions and never really feeling uncomfortable about not knowing answers. You know, you don't know the answer immediately with a medical diagnosis. You don't know the answer immediately when you're studying spectra of chiral small molecules like I do. And being able to have those discussions and being encouraged to have that kind of curiosity was something really, really important. But obviously my parents convinced my brother the right thing was to follow them and I just turned to physics. So, but I think a lot of that is to do with the teachers that I had at high school. I mean, I had really, really fantastic chemistry and physics teachers who just got me interested and inspired and excited about the subjects they were teaching. And I think without that, I would have never become the physicist that I am today.
Okay, that's a really cool pivot into outreach, because you've spoken about how outreach is pretty good at school level now, but the gender balance hasn't shifted in physics at undergraduate level. So what are we getting wrong?
It's really hard when we think about the representation of women in physics at A level and then at undergraduate are kind of directly linked, right? You couldn't have more at undergraduate than you do at A level. And unfortunately, we have such a terrible representation of girls in physics classrooms at A level, which for everyone who didn't attend school in the UK, A level is kind of what you do at 17 to 18 years old. It's our national exam for when you finish school and are about to attend university. And about 1 in 5 of the students studying physics A-level are girls, and that's not changed for 20, 30, 40 years. I think the really big challenge that we have in changing that number, which would obviously impact the representation of women in physics undergrad and then straight up through professor, is that we don't have many physics teachers who are specialists in physics. We have a lot of teachers who are biology teachers who may just get asked to cover a lesson on physics. We have a lot of teachers who trained in maths and then get asked to teach physics. And we sometimes, you know, in some schools, you have teachers who trained in sports science and get left teaching physics. And it's really hard to inspire young people, particularly kind of young people of today who are so savvy and have so many distractions. It's really hard to get them excited about physics unless you're also excited about physics. So we have this really big rate limiting step on exciting and inspiring young people to do physics A level because we don't have that really, really great, engaging, dynamic teaching force of physicists. And then we have a huge issue with representation. And when young people look up to the top of science, or when they look in their textbooks particularly, they see all of these old, if it's a textbook, often dead, white old men who were the physicists. They don't have a great teacher, and they don't get introduced to all of the really exciting physics and engineering and biophysics and chemistry that we're doing today. So they really just think it's a kind of out-of-date subject that's not done by very diverse people, that's actually quite boring because they're not taught it well. So outreach really needs to come in and change that.
And the problem with outreach at the moment is we're just talking to kids once a year at a million different schools.
I mean, part of it is that we go in and scientists think they'll save the day. So they go in, they drop in, and they do a talk at lunchtime and leave feeling really good for themselves, because it does feel really nice to talk to an audience of young people who are excited to hear from you. But really, that one talk that you gave for 1 hour isn't going to change that much. You know, you have to be there for the long term. I think bigger than that, it's kind of the influences that young people get from their teachers, from their parents. All of that really shapes their perspective of a subject. And something like physics, which can be so incredibly boring if it's taught badly, you know, your parents will have misconceptions about it, your teachers will have misconceptions about it, and no one really knows what physicists do as a job, right? I can't even imagine asking my teacher at high school now, what do you think that we do as researchers every day, because they wouldn't know. So there's misconceptions and there's that. But I think that my main problem with outreach in general, especially towards women or people of color or LGBTQ plus communities, is we've kind of got this idea that to make them want to study physics, to get girls to want to study physics, we have to run an event that's a kind of girls in physics event, when really we need to run a physics event where the speakers are all phenomenal women. Or we need to run a science event where we have a really great lineup of extraordinary Black researchers. Because at the moment, we kind of run this girls in physics event. We only invite girls. Boys don't see it. The girls who sign up are the ones who are probably already convinced. So we have this like cycle where we're supporting students who've already decided, and we're pushing students away who are kind of on the borderline or haven't yet decided. So that's kind of my main issue with a lot of the outreach initiatives that look to rectify these inequities in academia.
Yeah, and you had an experience that wasn't dissimilar to this, right? Where you were invited to a conference, realized you were the only woman, and then got together a group of speakers who are phenomenal women. And then you turn up and actually it's a women in science event.
So that's slightly different in that it wasn't an event for kids. So obviously, I think this is really important to talk about, but it's very much an academic focused thing. But often these scientific conferences will invite you to talk. And I got invited to this one that you're talking about. And I got sent a link to the website that it was happening. It was kind of a nanomaterials one. And it was in Paris. So I was like, oh, cool. I have a cousin in Paris. Paris is a nice place to go. I love the Eurostar, love Europe. So I'll just take a look at the website. And it was, you know, a nice 16-page wall of white male academics, entirely white, actually, which is quite surprising to see in physics. And it was, you know, disappointing and frustrating. And I emailed back and I said, I'd be happy to come and talk, but is there anything that we can do about the website? Because there doesn't seem to be any women speakers lined up. And the person organizing it wrote back and said, oh, that's because we don't have any women speakers. But if you have the capacity or if you know any, then feel free to invite some and we'd be happy to invite them as a speaker. And as you probably know, or as lots of listeners will know, it's quite important in your scientific career, particularly early on, to have these invitations, to have things that you can put on your CV to say invited speaker X. You know, we get very limited opportunities to do that normally. And so I wrote to some of the kind of really cool researchers I know who are working on great things and happen to be women and happen to be women of color and said, will you come and talk at this conference? Unfortunately, they don't have any money to cover our travel, but you know, it's only Paris, so we can probably make a Eurostar cheap. Anyway, in the end, the organizer arranged a special session just for me and the women that I'd invited, which was Women in Nanomaterials, which ran parallel to the main session. So you had this main session of 16 distinguished, eminent white guys talking to a huge lecture theater. And then genuinely, it was like we were put into the kind of reception office and we were all sitting around this terrible table with like an awful projector. You cannot make it up. And I remember I was texting my mom, like, I'm coming home. This is so bad. Like, I'm going to get on the next train. This is so terrible. And that kind of thing really doesn't support you as an academic. But that's far removed from schools. I hope that no young people in the school system today ever have to go through anything like that.
Running it in parallel is such nonsense.
Yeah, it was completely humiliating.
And then what happened from there? Did you say to the...
Yeah, I emailed when I was on the Eurostar home that evening and I said, I think this is completely ridiculous thing to do and just really embarrassing. And the person who organized it never emailed me back, but they did email a couple of months ago to say that they were doing this conference again. And I just, you know, auto-delete.
Straight into the trash.
Yeah. I mean, often Outlook does that for you, right? So when you get the opportunity to do it, you should always go for it.
Well, listen, so you're a huge fan of Angela Saini's book, Inferior. Can you characterize the ways, while we're on the topic, in which women have been misinterpreted and misrepresented in science?
Angela's book was really powerful. So for those who haven't heard it, it's called Inferior, The True Power of Women and the Science That Shows It. And I read the book in 2017, and I was kind of asked by the Institute of Physics. They have a publication called Physics World, which is their kind of monthly physics popular science communication magazine. And they said, do you want to review this book? And I hadn't read a book properly for reviewing it since I was, you know, at high school. I hadn't written a book review since I was at school. So I was very nervous about it. So I read the book about three times. I kept writing these drafts. I sent them to both my parents to read. I'd go and see Angela, everything she was speaking at. And then I just became really fascinated by this story. So Angela is trained as an engineer and then turned into a science writer. But she has become this incredible, almost kind of forensic investigative journalist. She went through all of the scientific studies, a lot of neuroscience, a lot of terrible neuroscience that has been set up to show that women are different to men. And what's really fascinating about Angela, and I think the reason that I was so kind of attracted and inspired by the book, was she wasn't writing to say women are better. She wasn't doing the research to say women are better than men and they deserve X. She was just doing it to look at the reasons that we have such gender inequality in society and try and understand why. And what that book really did for me, more than give me specific examples of how women have been hard done by, was taught me about bias in science and how if as a scientist, as a neuroscientist, as a gender researcher, as a whatever, you take your bias to the experiment and to the experimental design, your results, the outcomes will be informed by that experimental design. It will be informed by the bias that you had. And so you have these men in the 18th century, 19th century, looking at an incredibly unequal world, looking at a world where women can't graduate, they can't own property, they can't vote, and saying a result of this, we interpret this as women are intellectually inferior to men, when really it's society that's put them in this situation where they can't do anything. And I just found that kind of fascinating. And you see it, you know, time and time again now, you know, I often hear it, and I'm sure people have spoken about it on the podcast before, but you often hear maybe women just aren't that interested in physics. You know, we've only got 10% of physics professors in the UK are women, so women ergo must not be that interested. When really, it's because they haven't been given the opportunities that their male counterparts have had. Same thing with white researchers versus researchers from communities of color. We don't have enough black professors, not because they're disinterested in becoming professors, but because academia and society as a whole doesn't give them the opportunity to become professors. So really what that book taught me was so much about how we need to reflect on our own biases before doing anything, and how those who are in marginalized groups aren't there because of their own intellectual or any other kind of inferiority. They're there because of the structures that society has created.
Yeah, and it's even worse in science, because subtly the implication is if we're going to go do an experiment or we're going to go evaluate the evidence, that's now going to be delivering the truth on this matter, which is women aren't interested in science, or people from communities of color aren't interested in science. And it's dangerous for that reason, because all of a sudden they're assessing the data as if it is sort of this scientific method and it's neutral.
That's completely right. Every aspect of it, the bias has been built in. If you're going to try and evaluate girls' interest in physics by looking at the numbers who take it for A-level, then you've completely missed out on all of that bias that they grew up in this society that we live in, which massively stereotypes by gender, or the bias of their teacher in giving them the advice to choose which options, or the bias of their parents. Like, we forget that all of these data points, especially when they're about people and they're about people's choices, don't exist in a vacuum. It's happening in a society that's been built up to be structurally sexist, racist, you name it. Well, I hope, you know, these discussions have got a lot louder in the last year, and I hope they keep getting louder until we actually do something about it.
Yeah, and when you're doing the research, it's now purporting to be neutral, whereas really there's this massive lens of bias on top of the thing. And I guess any book that highlights that, like Inferior, I understand why it's so valuable then to get it out.
Yeah, I think it's so massively valuable. And, you know, I talk about this all the time with scientists and physicists, and they're like, oh, well, yeah, but it doesn't happen in chemistry, but it doesn't happen in material science, but it doesn't happen in engineering. But of course, your bias comes into the way you design an experiment. Of course, you kind of think, you know, when you're writing a paper, when you're putting together a discussion, it's very rare that you just, you know, do an experiment, you put none of your own influence on it, something fascinating happens and you publish the paper. It's usually, oh, we want to show X for Y. And that means that you're biased by the way that you're designing and starting it. So I think that we're just completely naive to think that because we don't work in social science, our own personal bias doesn't matter, because actually it matters in not only scientific experiments, but who we recruit, the ideas we bring into our labs. All of that is influenced by our personal bias and misconceptions. And I think we just need, as a scientific community, to get a lot more savvy about identifying and rectifying that.
Yeah, and that's actually not such an edgy view when you think about it. We all in another context know we have confirmation bias, and all these other kinds of biases that affect us all the time. And that's very well proven. So it would be strange in one way to actually think, well, when it comes to the sciences, well, because they're not social sciences, that just goes out the window. That's actually kind of an outlandish view when you put it like that.
But I think we just don't get taught it. We don't get trained it. You know, you don't have computer science departments. You train all the students in computer science departments how to design a machine learning algorithm or how to mine data using artificial intelligence. You don't train them at all on the ethics of doing these things, or on the kind of reasons that these approaches may not necessarily benefit everyone and everything in society. I think because of how separated and distinct the education system is in the UK, we've really, really split the consideration of people and impacts and outcomes and biases and ethics from the technical science training. I would have loved to have a course at undergraduate level in physics on kind of the context by which people made discoveries, the reasons that every old legend we're reading about was a very privileged white man. And I think computer science would love to have more discussions of the ethics around the tech they're creating, but we just don't comprehensively have access to that yet.
This podcast episode is sponsored by BioBox Analytics. BioBox is a data analytics platform designed for scientists and clinicians working with next-generation sequencing data. With BioBox, you can design and run bioinformatic pipelines on demand, generate publication-ready plots, and discover insights using popular public databases. Spots are limited, so sign up for the waitlist and be the first to access a free account at biobox.io.
So, it's a slight change of topic, but it's on theme. What have you been up to on Wikipedia? Because the answer is kind of lots.
Yeah, lots. It would be great if I just finished it there. So yeah. I should say it's Wikipedia's birthday. Wikipedia turned 20 on Friday. So that's really exciting for Wikipedia. Ever since reading Angela's book, actually, so it's really not changing topic a lot. Ever since reading her book, I was really compelled and inspired that we needed to better tell the stories of all these women who've been standing up, who have been talking back, who have been saying this isn't right, who have been saying, you know, you can't judge my intellect based on my position in society, in a biased society that you've created. And actually, I was going through that book and looking up so many of the fantastic women that she wrote about, and often they weren't on Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is obviously a massively important platform. It's always in the top five most frequently visited websites in the world, which is quite staggering for a site that doesn't make any money from advertising, right? It's an entirely open source, community-led encyclopedia. I think that the English-speaking Wikipedia gets about 15 billion page views a month. I can't even imagine a number that big, how many people are looking at it. And what's really struck me is how it's used by so many different aspects of society, from kind of teaching to journalists and technology, but also influencing the direction of science, especially in interdisciplinary areas like I work on. So I knew Wikipedia was important, but I didn't know until I read Angela's book and started doing a little bit more digging about how biased the content on Wikipedia was. Just like textbooks that you might buy in high school, all of that content has been written by someone. And unfortunately, Wikipedia has a really big problem in the diversity of editors. About 80 to 90% of Wikipedia editors are men. The majority are white men in North America. And as a result of that, the majority of content reflects their interests. And ever since Wikipedia began, women and people of color have been very, very poorly represented in the biographies. So if you look at the 1.7 million biographies on English speaking Wikipedia, less than one in five of them are about women, and the representation of women of color will be even more minute. And so when I read that and started thinking and hearing more about how important Wikipedia was as a resource, I kind of thought, I have to change this. You know, I have a lot of dead time in my day when I'm playing on my computer and watching TV, and I can be someone who contributes that time in a productive manner. And so I started writing the biographies of women scientists and people of color scientists, and particularly trying to focus on scientists who are phenomenal, who've done absolutely brilliant research, but aren't yet public names. And I was amazed how many of them I could find. So I started this at the beginning of 2018. I've done them every single day and I'm still going. So I'm 1,250 biographies in and still finding people to write about every single day. And it's just been this amazing journey, you know? So when you ask, like, what are your interactions with Wikipedia? I've written a whole bunch of pages. I've been to train people all over the world in a whole bunch of different languages. I've actually worked with lots of professional bodies of scientists, so like the Royal Society of Chemistry or the American Physical Society, to help them run editathons to train scientists in how to contribute to Wikipedia, both about their scientific knowledge, which is incredibly important for people in the global south who may not have access to the textbooks and printed material we do, but also to write the pages of other incredible physicists, because actually Wikipedia has given us this option for the first time ever in history to democratize access to information and to really collaboratively write our own story, write the story of who's doing what now, write the story of who did what then. And I had this amazing quote that, you know, the majority of history and the majority of textbooks are written by white men, for white men, about other white men. And Wikipedia is the only global platform where we have the opportunity to rectify that. So yeah, my Wikipedia journey started in 2018 and it's going strong.
With Wikipedia being the only platform where really that can be rectified, it's obviously 100%. Quite important it is rectified.
It's massively important, but it's also just quite extraordinary when you think about the numbers of people who use it. You know, quite amazing when you think about the numbers of people who read those pages, if you link them to pages on a particular topic. If I'm writing about a woman working on solar panels and I link it to the page on climate change, if you're writing about an award winner and you link it to the research that they do or the professional body site that they're on, you can't imagine how many people are impacted by that information. And for me, I just kind of casually sit there in the evening with my laptop on my lap, writing these pages. And you just think, actually, you're doing something to tell the story, but you're also celebrating and recognizing the person that you're writing about. You know, they should be on there. They should be publicly known information as much as they're happy and willing to share. I think it's really exciting work for that reason. And really, you know, greedily, I get to learn about so many different kinds of cool science that I wouldn't have the capacity to do otherwise. You know, I read very niche science papers in my day job on kind of the intersection of materials and chemistry, but I get to learn about psychology, I get to learn about social science, I get to learn about neuroscience, I get to learn about archaeology when I'm writing these Wikipedia pages, and it's just brilliant for that.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable project. How do you go about selecting the women, and then how do you go about researching them? The irony being they don't have a Wikipedia page pre-existing for you to go leverage.
Yeah, I mean, I actually get quite a lot of information incredibly quickly. You know, we've been trained, and lots of the listeners will have been trained, in how to do a literature review, in how to identify reliable sources, in how to put together an argument in a neutral manner, but where you are trying to convince people. So when you're writing this page, you have to convince other Wikipedia editors that this person is notable enough to stay on the site. Wikipedia is a general interest encyclopedia, so obviously not everyone should be on there, and not everything, and not every city, and not every, you know, street sign. But notable people and notable items can be on there. So the first job you have as a Wikipedia editor is trying to convince people that this person is notable. And there's a certain set of notability criteria, which are kind of a little bit frustrating because they can reinforce this bias in academic culture. You know, notability is evaluated based on the number of awards someone's won, the position they hold within a university, if they have a named chair, whether they've brought in a huge amount of money through grant funding, whether they've published a huge number of high impact papers. And we know in academia that all of those different criteria are biased towards white, successful, privileged men. So one part of it is a little bit frustrating, but actually, you know, every single day since I started this project, I've found phenomenal women and people of color to write about who easily fulfill these criteria. It's not that they're not out there, it's just that we're not looking hard enough. And then I just, you know, like every person who's great on their internet browser, I have like 50 tabs open, kind of documenting every aspect of this person's life from when they were, well, sometimes it's hard to find where they were born, but from where they went to high school, to where they did their PhD, to who their thesis advisor was, to when they got their first postdoc, to when they maybe worked in industry, and then just start putting together their story. And I think, you know, I didn't do history after the age of 14, but it's given me a huge appreciation of history and how you put together a story and where you go to for content and the use of archives and libraries. It's an adventure when you're writing these pages. So it's kind of a rush when you find out facts. I absolutely love it when I can find someone's PhD thesis, or if it's a woman that you're writing about, it's a great thing when you can find their maiden name if they've got married, because then you can find so much more about their early training. So there are all these different things that just make it a real privilege to write these biographies.
That sounds like such an adventure.
It's an adventure every night without having to leave the comfort and safety and COVID secure living room.
You can almost, I guess, also like live slightly vicariously through these people, right? If you're tracking their life from the time they first discovered the science, the challenges they faced, how they got writing, where they got writing, what they got writing about.
Yeah, and it gives you kind of context for what academic careers really are. Because I think, you know, as young scientists, as early career researchers, we're trained to think that you have to do great in your undergrad, you have to be exceptional in your PhD, you have to be that brilliant postdoc, then you have to get that lectureship really early, then you have to bring in that huge grant, then you have to do this. When really, most careers are quite nonlinear. Some people take time out to have kids, some people take time out to work in industry, some people completely switch fields, and they manage to regenerate themselves and be successful. So it doesn't only give you this privilege of letting you see all of their research, but it also shows you what scientific life is actually like, not the stuff that we, you know, hear about or have these misconceptions about. But it does make you want to change discipline every single evening. So I'm like, why am I not on a massive boat collecting corals from the ocean? Why am I in this spectroscopy lab? So you do have that to balance with all the excitement.
Yeah, it must be liberating too, to realize that actually people's lives are messy, right?
Everyone's life is messy. If their life is boring, then I've not written their Wikipedia page.
Yeah, because the pressure basically comes, and this isn't all fields, but academia particularly, from, I guess, the idea that I have to follow this particular path, and it's a very difficult path, and it's a very greasy pole. And if I diverge from the path, well, now I'm in trouble. So actually seeing a whole bunch of people who are notable and brilliant and successful, who haven't stuck to this kind of make-believe abstract linear path, must be really cool.
It's completely inspiring. And it's something that, you know, doing this Wikipedia training for other people, whether that's undergrads or graduate students or school kids, really letting them see that too is really, really important. Like letting them realize that you don't have to have everything planned when you're in your first year of your degree. You don't even have to have everything planned when you're in your first year of your postdoc or your fellowship. You know, everything happens. Oh man, now I sound like a weird singer. I was about to say everything happens for a reason, but you will identify the path that you want to go on, and it will be inspired by the people you meet and the connections you make. And I think that that's something that has really shown me.
Yeah, there was an interesting detail in there too about how the Wikipedia criteria is, well, it's how many publications have you got? How many grants have you brought in? And that clearly isn't exactly egalitarian, because the structure in which people make those achievements isn't neutral. But I wonder if academia is like that anyway. And if you're going for a position, well, they're going to look at how many citations you've got. They're going to be looking at the quality of your grant funding, et cetera, et cetera. But then the people who have already got a little bit of evidence of what they've done are people who have existed in conditions where it's very easy, relatively speaking, to do so. So do you find that academia, for the same reason Wikipedia runs into not necessarily being the most representative all the time, that actually academia and science has the same issue?
I completely think it has done historically. I think that we've reinforced the kind of privilege, like, you know, if you've been successful in science, you will have more outputs. The outputs are what you're judged on next time. So you'll be more successful in science. The people who get the biggest, you know, multi-million pound research grants are the ones who already have quite a lot of money and don't actually need more students and PhD students. It's very hard to establish yourself as an academic who may not have the human power to do the research that will lead to the number of publications you need to get X and Y. I'm really hoping, and I actually genuinely believe it, that we're starting to see movement on that. So the EPSRC, which is the big Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, who've funded, you know, the majority of chemistry, physics, engineering research, they've now got a fellowship scheme which will allow you as a prestigious distinguished fellow to have 1 or 2 days a week to do policy or diversity work. So as part of your research salary, you'll have dedicated time, you know, 1 day a week is a huge amount of time to do meaningful work to change the scientific community. We've had calls from the Wellcome Trust and from other professional bodies to really think about behavior in science and to think about this research culture that you're talking about. And actually, there's a lot of really great positive moves from leaders across Imperial and more broadly to stop looking at citation counts and journal impact factors and all of this kind of rubbish metrics that reinforce the privilege that we spoke about before, and to start really evaluating people based on the quality of the science that they do and the quality of the teaching that they do too. This is something that we often forget in conversations about academia, that you are a researcher, but you've also got this position where you're teaching the next generations of researchers. And I think historically that hasn't been put on the same level, given the same kind of representation as research when it comes to these evaluations, but it's starting to happen. So I really think that we're starting to see really positive change, both in what people research, how we evaluate researchers, and also how we give merit and warrant to things that aren't necessarily, you know, technical science discoveries, but are improving the student experience or the research community.
Yeah, and it's really cool to hear that the incentives are actually changing. These things are being built into paid contracts.
It's completely cool. And actually, from your perspective, as someone who makes podcasts and is interested in this kind of intersection between public engagement and science, you have a lot of movement now where scientists are being honored and valued for their public engagement, you know, very differently to what happened before, where if you're a professor who went off and did lectures at the Royal Institution, you wouldn't necessarily be respected by your colleagues, and it definitely wouldn't be on the university website. Whereas now it's a huge honor and a privilege, and it's seen as something that's really great for the community. So I think now these things are really happening, and some universities let you do it as time out of your day job to go and do this public engagement or radio or television work. But that's something that's really very recent and I think will have a really big impact.
Before we finish up, I'd love to ask you about social media, because you wrote a paper called The Reward and Risk of Social Media for Academics. And I was interested in what came out of that in the way of conclusions.
Basically that Twitter's great. There we go, we can wrap up. No, so it was me and actually two of my most favorite colleagues, a professor called Chris Jackson, who's unfortunately leaving Imperial to go and join Manchester, but is one of the most extraordinary earth scientists and an extraordinary science communicator. And also Dr. Ben Britton, who's about to also leave Imperial to become an associate professor in Canada. And we actually, as scientists, despite all working on the same campus in the same postcode, had never met before we all met on Twitter. And then we all met and became quite good friends and quite good kind of, I'd say we have fantastic discussions about where academia needs to go to and who we need to recognize and honor. And we realized how important Twitter had been, not only for our friendship, but also for kind of advancing our scientific careers. So as I mentioned, Chris does all this great public engagement and outreach. He's one of very few Black professors in the UK, one of a handful at Imperial. And he's used his platforms to really advocate for people to look at structural racism and institutional racism in their departments. He's used it to do really extraordinary, I've said extraordinary three times about Chris, three really incredible outreach. He's spoken at the Royal Institution. He was one of their Christmas lecturers this year. And he's just very engaging. His Twitter feed is constantly either fantastic photos of his family or talking about the salt basins that he works on. But he's been a really great, powerful force on social media. Ben similarly has used it in a kind of, from a social justice perspective, to have really detailed and necessary conversations on the support that LGBTQ plus scientists have faced. I've used it a lot to advocate for women and other marginalized groups. And we realized how important it had been in letting us as scientists have this different aspect of our personality, but also to share scientific papers, to share job opportunities, to potentially reach new collaborators who aren't in the kind of, you know, particular niche that you are in science. I do a lot of experiments at Beamlines, which are kind of big national scientific facilities. And when you get time on a Beamline, in conventional times, not in COVID times, you get kind of 72 hours where you have to go there and do experiments for 72 hours. So you can't sleep, you have to eat rubbish school food, and you stay up all the time and you do these experiments. And having the opportunity from your pocket to connect with a scientist in New York or a physicist in Australia is really extraordinary during those moments where you're often quite isolated. So we kind of just got together and thought, Twitter's been really great for us. And hopefully in writing that article, we can make people think that it's useful and great for them as well.
Okay, so Twitter good. Instagram less so?
Instagram's fine. I mean, I think it's just such a ridiculous perception of people's lives. You know, it's exactly what they pre-curated and chosen to put up. Other people can correct me and I'm sure I'm wrong, but Instagram is very brilliant for community building. You have a really great network of women scientists on there, young women scientists who are all connecting with each other and being very supportive of one another. I've yet to see it being a great place to share scientific discoveries or share a job advert that you have for a PhD candidate, or to connect with the editors of a journal. You know, when you go on Twitter, you have professors, you have journal editors, you have magazine writers, all there who are kind of on an equal footing to you. You know, you can just send them a DM and ask for something. I don't see that yet on Instagram. I see a lot of really great science communication to the general public. And I see a lot of people who are in marginalized communities supporting one another, but not that opportunity to network within the scientific community.
Yeah, that's almost a slightly different muscle, isn't it? The ability to network and share research, et cetera.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, we all need to get better at practicing at, and especially sharing our research with the public, given that they're funding the majority of the research that we do. And I've just personally felt Twitter's a better platform for doing that on.
Well, Jessica, that was so much fun. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamie, and have a great evening, afternoon, morning, wherever you are.
Well, everyone, that was The Scientist Podcast, and that was Dr. Jessica Ward. As always, it's been great to have you listening, and we'll see you next week.